It's the Mixed Martial Arts Hour with
The Mixed Martial Arts Hour is back in your life on this Monday, February 20th, 2012. And I'm not going to lie to you. I will let you know that we're actually taping this on a Friday, February 17th, 2012. The reason we are taping this show on Friday is because on Monday, when you're probably watching this or listening to this for the first time, I will be on a plane to the land of the rising sun for my first trip over to Japan, UFC 144, of course, this weekend at the Saitama Super Arena in Saitama, Japan. My first ever trip to Japan. I cannot even tell you how excited I am to be going over there for the first time. So, because we didn't want to miss a week, we're doing the show on Friday, but lots to get to, so let us get right into it. Of course, we're coming off UFC on Fuel TV number one. We're going to talk about that a little later on. We're going to talk to, actually, Sean Loeffler, who was supposed to fight on UFC on Fuel TV 1. Unfortunately, just five or so minutes before his debut fight in the UFC against Buddy Roberts, he injured his ankle and was off the card. He couldn't fight. His ankle became swollen like the size of, a tennis ball or something like that. And he was warming up, twisted his ankle, and we'll get an update on the ankle, how he's feeling, how long he expects to be out. This is a guy who has been in MMA for 12 years. He's been working so hard to get to this point, and then he gets injured 5 minutes before his debut fight inside the octagon. So we'll talk to him about that. We'll also talk to Mauro Ranallo, the voice of Strikeforce. We'll talk to him about Ronda Rousey versus Miesha Tate. And, of course, the UFC's return to Japan. Mauro has been to Japan like 30 times or something like that, calling Pride fights. And we'll get his two cents on what it's going to be like over there. And perhaps he'll give me some pointers as to what I should do when I'm over in Japan. We'll also talk to Joe Lauzon, who will be fighting Anthony Showtime Pettis at UFC 144. It's a huge lightweight fight. The winner, definitely a top contender. We'll talk to Joe about his last win over Melvin Gallard, this fight against Showtime and fighting over in Japan. But first, we go to Japan for our very first guest. We're starting things off in the land of the rising sun, and we welcome in, I believe for the second time on our show, our old friend, former colleague, and a very good friend of mine, Mr. Daniel Herberton, joining us at a very early slash late hour. I'm not sure about his sleeping patterns, but nonetheless, it is dark outside in Japan, and we very much appreciate him joining us. Daniel, how are you?
Hey, Ariel, I'm good, thank you.
So good to hear from you, Daniel.
Yeah, second time.
Oh, yes, it is the second time. Okay, and this time under better circumstances. It is so good to hear from you. And, of course, before we get into all the UFC 44 talk, 144 talk, excuse me, of course, you are a very big part of our site, and we loved working with you over at MMAfighting.com, and I'm sure there are a lot of loyal fans of the site who are wondering what you've been up to. So give us an update. What has Daniel Herberton been doing for the last 2 months?
I took a little bit of time off to go back to Australia. I've actually moved back to Australia now, and I'm just back in Japan for the UFC. I've been writing Fighters Only magazine. Has a huge Japanese issue out right now. We've got interviews with pretty much everybody on the UFC card, and a lot of content about UFC 144. So I've been taking a little bit of time away, but now we're getting close to fight week, so I'm picking things up again.
And by the way, you can't see the stream right now, but you are the proud owner of the greatest profile pic that we've ever had in our show's history. I found an amazing picture of you with a beard, and you're looking into the light, and you look like the Wolfman. It's really unbelievable stuff. So kudos to you. Do you know the one that I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
It's unbelievable. I hope that you can... do you have a beard like that right now? Because if you can recreate that for me over in Japan, that would be wonderful.
I shaved it yesterday. Oh. I went to interview Megumi Fuji today, and I didn't want to scare it too much.
very good idea there. Okay, so I can't wait to get over there. And by the way, how long have you been back in Japan for since you moved back to Australia? How long have you been
now.
There? A month, you said?
Yeah.
All right, so the first question is, this is the UFC's return to Japan for the first time since December 2000. What is the buzz like there? I mean, do you sense a buzz? And of course, the scene over in Japan right now for MMA has been a little dry, so are people excited to have the UFC return there?
Yeah, dry is an understatement. This is probably the lowest MMA has ever been in Japan. it's absolute bottom right now. Personally, I don't really feel too much of a buzz. I haven't seen any advertising. Apparently, it is around, but I haven't seen any advertising for the event, and there isn't a real lot of hype. But I mean, within the hardcore fans, yeah, they're excited to come and see the UFC, but it's certainly not anything like you saw in Brazil or we've seen in Australia, where it was a huge explosion of popularity. It's certainly nothing like that.
And are people expecting this to be the UFC show? You know, Dana told me on Wednesday after the Fuel TV fight that they're not going to do any sort of pride tributes. It's going to be a UFC-type show like we know and see all over America and across the world. Are people expecting it to look like a Japanese show, or are they expecting it to look like the typical UFC event?
No, they're expecting it to be a UFC event. The attraction there is they want to see a UFC event. I mean, everybody in Japan has seen a Pride event, so, yeah. They made the right decision in that case, although I think the card itself is a little bit lacking for Japanese fans.
Okay, first let me ask you about what you first said there, because there were a lot of fans online reading the pundits, so to speak, who said that it's a mistake to bring the UFC-type show with the music and the lights and all that, that the fans there won't really they won't get excited and they won't really react to it well. Is that a mistake on their part to think that you're saying that the Japanese fans want to see the American experience, so to speak?
Well, then it's only going to appeal to the hardcore fans anyway, and the hardcore fans are obviously interested in seeing the biggest show in the world right now. The general Japanese population who perhaps isn't so interested in MMA, it would not be a good match for them. But the people who are buying tickets to UFC 144 are the hardcore fans that are still in Japan, and it works for them. I mean, they want to see the American side of things. That's part of the attraction.
Do you have any idea how many tickets they've sold for the event thus far?
I mean, I've only heard kind of secondhand. I heard 15,000. That was a week or so ago. I know tickets are still available. They were originally configuring the arena as a Saitama Super Arena. Has had about 50,000 people in there before for Dream events and Pride events. UFC are configuring it for 17,000. They're blocking off the top levels, and I believe that 15,000 have been sold so far. Although some people have claimed that that's kind of that's paper ticket sales, as in someone's bought them up. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned also that the card is lacking a little bit, and that's interesting because from our perspective here in the United States, I think this is top to bottom the best card of the year in terms of the UFC. In terms of, you know, lately we've been getting some undercards that have been a little weak. Top to bottom, though, I think it's the card that has the best matchups. Why, from a Japanese perspective, is this card lacking a little bit, as you say?
Okay, well, I mean, going through the card, Frankie Edgar and Ben Henderson, you got Ryan Bader, Chet Congo, Jake Shields, Anthony Pettis, Joe Lozon. Japanese people don't know those guys flat out, and that's almost the entire main card. Hatsu Hiyoki and Yushin Okami were recently promoted to the main card, which is a really good move. But outside Mark Hunt, Quentin Rampage Jackson, Akiyama, Japanese people just do not know the people on the main card. I mean, they may have a general idea who Frankie Edgar is because of his fights with Gray Maynard, that they, you know, that they were quite popular in Japan, or they create quite a buzz. But the other guys, they literally have no idea who they are.
Do you think
it's just not really possible to be a UFC fan in Japan with the current TV deals that they have?
What is the current TV deal that they have?
Right now they're on Wow Wow, which is a private satellite TV, and also on NTT's Hikari TV, which is a fiber optics TV, which is kind of packaged with internet. Going through their public subscription numbers, that looks like that totals about 4 million subscribers. Out of the 128 million people in Japan.
Oh. So Wow Wow is like a specialty channel. Wow Wow is like a specialty channel that you have to pay for.
Yes, that's right. Cable subscription channels is not popular at all here. I mean, 4 million out of 128 million is really nothing.
And is this fight, because it's a special fight, because it's the UFC's return to Japan, will they air it on free television, or is it still going to air on WowWow?
No. They were attempting to work out a deal to get on free-to-air TV, but it's just not happening at this point. Japanese promotions have been posting just absolutely atrocious ratings on Japanese network TV. This past New Year's Eve was the first New Year's Eve since 2003 that there has not been any mixed martial arts on television. It is at its absolute lowest, and no TV company, no network TV would be willing to take the risk with an MMA event right now.
Why do you think that is?
It's just not popular. It's a country that goes through phases, and now is not the MMA phase. Boxing is still quite popular. There's still numerous world champions in boxing, and they're on network TV. Those fights are on network TV. But mixed martial arts is very, 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 very low popularity right now.
Let's say I give you boxing, pro wrestling, MMA. Rank them in terms of popularity right now in Japan.
Boxing is without a doubt number one. Recently, they were drawing like 50% ratings on TV, 66 million viewers.
Wow.
Pro wrestling and MMA are absolutely tiny, really niche. It's no comparison at all.
What do you think? I mean, I remember, what was it, 7 or so years ago, Bob Sapp and all that, when MMA was just gigantic from what we were hearing back here. What do you think? Is there one thing that sort of killed it, or was it the lack of building stars, the death of pride, perhaps TV situations and whatnot? What would you attribute this rise and then fall of MMA in the country?
It's quite a long story. It begins with Pride, Pride's Yakuza ties being exposed. When Pride was outed as basically a Yakuza, an organized crime organization, all TV deals were cut for them. They lost all their sponsors, and as we know, they eventually sold out to the UFC, or sold out to Zuffa, and disappeared. There was a lot of trust was lost at that time, and the torch was passed to K1, basically, the kickboxing organization. Unfortunately, K1 were booking fights like Bob Sapp versus Akebono being a sumo, and Bob Sapp perhaps not being the most legitimate martial artist. That's what their main events were. That their focus had shifted from legitimate sports over to these freak fights. And after a while, you begin to, once you've seen one freak fight, you've seen them all, and popularity just kept going down and down and down. And there's more scandals within K1. They haven't been paying people, and they're effectively done now. It's gone. I mean, it's fallen. I've been in Japan for 6 years now, and it's fallen off so far that I was forced to move the country, to leave the country.
Is it shocking to you that it was able to fall this quickly? And in some ways, it almost mirrors the rise of the UFC here. They went down quickly. The UFC rose very quickly. Is that shocking for someone who's been around the sport for so long, especially living over there?
It is shocking. I mean, the UFC still has not reached the level of popularity that Pride had in Japan. Pride was the biggest sport in Japan for many years. Well, mixed martial arts is the biggest sport in Japan for many years. It was huge. Nothing. UFC, it's like if the UFC on Fox were posting, 40% ratings, 50% ratings. It was enormous in Japan. And then basically one series of articles that exposed Yakuza ties, that was all gone within 2 or 3 years. It was really, really sudden.
Do you think that the return of the UFC can ignite the fan base over there, or do you think it's still going to take 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years and even though the UFC may want to come back every year, twice a year or whatever, it's going to take a local promotion to grow up, build all these new stars, local stars, people that the fans over there can relate to. Basically, even if the UFC comes once or twice a year, will it still be business as usual over there, and the sport will remain a niche sport as opposed to what it once was?
I don't think the UFC has any chance of sparking another fight sport boom in Japan. There will be no explosion of popularity simply because they don't have the reach. I mean, people who go and watch these fights, they will be entertained. It is an amazing card, but it's people in Japan won't see it, and they don't have a chance to be educated about the UFC unless the UFC are able to put together a much, much better TV deal, which would be extremely expensive. It would be more cost-effective to go into a country like South Korea that's already completely obsessed with the UFC. Japan is just not ready for MMA at this point. It's almost completely gone at a major level. It's still doing okay at a grassroots level. But what the UFC is doing now, I think, is quite smart, because although this event won't be a huge explosion in popularity like we saw in Australia or in England and Brazil, it gives them, it's like an investment, because, you know, if they do one or two shows every year for a number of years, when MMA is ready to make a comeback again, perhaps if there's a Japanese UFC champion, the UFC will have a better history in Japan and more pull in perhaps getting a better network TV deal, more fans. So it's more of an investment for the future rather than an attempt at sparking any sort of boom, I think.
From the people that you have spoken to who are in the know about the UFC's return to Japan, how do they feel about the show taking place on a Sunday morning, rather early there, like 8 or 9 a.m., so that it can air in its usual time slot here in the United States on Saturday night?
It's kind of annoying. I mean, going up to Saitama is north of Tokyo. It's about an hour north of central Tokyo. It's very cold up there. It's not really fun to go up there. But it's not going to stop any of the hardcore fans going. Perhaps some of the people who are, sitting on the fence as to whether they're going to buy a ticket aren't going to go. But, I mean, it does kind of feel like I have heard the sentiment that people are saying that, it doesn't really feel like where the main focus of this event is for the pay-per-view. But it's not a huge factor in ticket sales or anything like that, no.
Is it a understatement to say that the UFC dropped the ball mightily by not having the likes of Antonio Rodrigo Nogueira, Vanderlei Silva, old Pride stars who are on their roster currently? They did put Rampage, which obviously was smart, and he was campaigning for this. And as you mentioned, you have guys like Akiyama and Hioki and Takanori Gomi. But those guys who were part of the boom a few years ago in Pride aren't on this card, and it would seem to me like they should have been. It was a no-brainer. So do you think they would have received a lot more attention had they put those guys on this card?
Yeah, it is quite confusing. I mean, the UFC announced that it's been known for a very long time that they wanted to hold an event in Japan. I believe the first press conference was in February 2011. So they had time to, work their bookings. It made absolute sense to have guys like Vanderlei Silva and Nogueira at an absolute minimum. You could put Krokop on there. King Mo was campaigning to get on here. Uriah Faber versus Keith Yamamoto would have been a huge fight in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
It would have helped a lot with PR efforts, but it's very confusing. I don't know why Joe Silva chose to put this card together. I don't think it's a very good match for Japan. I don't know if he was making a statement about bringing the UFC to Japan rather than, doing a bit of a Pride throwback show. I don't think it's a good match, and their PR is going to hurt because of it. It would have sold itself otherwise.
Right. I think, if I may drop my two cents, I think that the problem is that there are too many shows, and you need to plug these guys in. So instead of having Nogueira fight on this card, they needed him for Toronto. And instead of you know, Vanderlei Silva fighting. They needed him, you know, for that San Jose card, and now they need him for Tough. So I just think there's so many shows that it's hard to plan that far in advance. They need to fulfill the shows that are upcoming, and then they'll sort of worry about it. And again, I don't think that's the best method. Just a couple of minutes left here with Daniel Herbertson, and then we'll get to Mauro Ranallo, who, of course, knows a lot about the scene over in Japan. We have seen shows like ONE FC and Legend Fighting Championship, some other shows pop up in Japan recently, while Dream and obviously Sengoku have been struggling. What do you think about their chances? Do you think that those guys can do anything, make some noise over there?
They're making all the right moves. They're getting both Legend FC and ONE FC have picked up deals with ESPN. They've got excellent broadcast deals and sponsorship, which is a really good start. They're very solid. They're taking quite different approaches, though. Legend's taking a bit of a slow and steady approach. They're a little bit under the radar, I think, for most MMA fans, whereas ONE FC is they're definitely giving themselves the appearance of a big show. I don't know how wise it is to book guys like Bob Sapp. I don't know if it's good value for money, but I don't know if they'll ever be as big as Pride or anything like that, but there's a big future.
All right, we look forward.
Asia's a big place. There's a lot of people here, and they all get martial arts, and that's not something to ignore.
Final thing on this card coming up on Saturday in Saitama. Actually, it's coming up on Sunday in Saitama, Saturday here in the United States. Obviously, you mentioned Asia being a big place, and this fight is taking place in Japan. You said earlier that South Korea is you know, going gaga over the UFC. Does Ben Henderson's roots, the fact that his mother is from Korea, does that help anything, or do people not really care about that?
No, people don't care.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah. It's like if I were good to go to the States and say, hey, I've got a... My dad was from Canada or something like that.
No, and I'm not trying to be ignorant. I know that Korea and Japan are two different places, but I was wondering if over there, if you had, because you said that it's blowing up in Korea, so I was wondering if you knew over in Korea, if people are going gaga over him coming back to Asia or anything like that. I don't know. I was trying to...
No, not at all. Okay. I mean, if anything, being Korean in Japan is not an advantage. I mean, Yoshihiro Akiyama,
right,
is a Zainichi Korean, which means he kept his Korean ethnicity. He's Korean passport, even though he was born in Japan, and that's really hurt his judo career. It's really hurt his popularity. It's made him more famous, but being Korean is there's a long history between Japan and Korea, and it's certainly not an angle that would bring you popularity. Will bring someone like Benson Henderson popularity anyway.
Right. All right. Well, it goes down Saturday night on pay-per-view, UFC 144. We've got the prelims on FX. I will be there on Tuesday getting ready for all the pre-fight stuff. We'll have all the pre-fight stuff for you on MMAfighting.com. Will you show me a good time, Daniel? That's the most important question.
I'll show you a very good time, Ariel.
All right.
You don't want to tell anybody about it when you go home.
Oh, wow. This is like an Asian Las Vegas here. This is very exciting. Cannot
exactly.
Wait for it. Thank you so much, Daniel. And most importantly, thank you so much for staying up late to do this. And we miss you over there at MMAfighting.com. Happy to hear you're doing well. And very much looking forward to seeing you next week in Japan.
Thanks, Ariel.
All right, there he is, Daniel Herbertson, joining us from Tokyo, Japan. It is approximately 3:30 a.m. over there. What a great guy staying up to do this interview and dropping some great insight on the scene over there in Japan right now. A interesting time for MMA in Japan. Who would have thunk it 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago that maybe a little less than that, but 5 or so years ago that we would be in the state that we are in now. And I think the UFC is trying to capitalize on the fact that MMA in Japan is a little dry, and they're going to try to reignite the scene over there. And one man who was a part of the scene when it was at its highest and when it was booming more so than anything we've ever seen here in the United States was the guy who is joining us right now, the guy who was once the voice of Pride Fighting Championships, now the voice of Strikeforce, and also hosts a great podcast, a daily podcast, which is really the MMA podcast if you want to listen to his show on a daily basis. He is, of course, Mauro Ranallo, joining us right now from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Mauro, how are you?
Doing very well. Titan of Twitter, always a pleasure to talk to you on your forum. And, yeah, very excited that you finally get to experience what, you know, some of us got to enjoy all those years ago.
Now, what's it like for you? And you will not be attending the event in Japan, correct?
Yeah, no, it's with mixed feelings that I will not be attending the event in Japan. There were plans to be sent over by my employer in Canada, the Score Television Network. Unfortunately, they decided that it would not be, I guess, fiscally responsible. It is an expensive foray after all. And but yet, you know, a part of me will be sad that I won't be back in the Saitama Super Arena for the, you know, the UFC's first event there, because, again, a venue that was built by the legendary Pride Fighting Championships and a place that will always, you know, hold a very, very special place in my heart.
How many events have you called at Saitama?
To be honest with you, that's a good question. I called 31 events in total in my 3 years, and it was almost, you know, to the day, 3 years that I spent with Pride Fighting Championships, the majority of which were in the Saitama Super Arena, but we also held events at the Osaka Castle Hall in Nagoya, Japan, the Yokohama Arena. So I was, you know, very fortunate to be a part of the Pride Fighting Championships tour of the wonderful country of Japan. But Saitama Super Arena is really, you know, the MSG, as it were, for mixed martial arts in Japan. And like I say, I'm glad the UFC is going back, and it's going to be interesting to see how it's received. I know that Dana's already said that, you know, they're, and rightfully so to a large degree, this is a UFC event. He has no, you know, responsibility to even pay tribute to Pride if he doesn't want to. I'm sure Quentin Rampage Jackson and others who are on the card who cut their teeth, you know, made their bones in Pride, will be paying, you know, tribute to the memories that were. But I'm just hoping it's a good event. On paper, it seems like it could be a very fun card. But yeah, you know, I think that's the best way to describe it, Saitama, as the MSG of Japanese MMA.
Now, we were just talking to Daniel Herbertson, who has been covering the Japanese scene for a very long time over there, and he said essentially that the UFC dropped the ball with this card by not having some of those big Pride names. They had you know, decided to put Rampage and Gomi and some of those guys, but not the Nogueras and the Vanderlei Silvas of the world. Do you also agree that the UFC dropped the ball with the way they booked this card?
Yeah, you know, there's a part of me that, yeah, it would be nice to do some kind of a tribute to Pride Fighting Championships, just knowing that, you know, was the promotion that I think even spawned Dana White's, you know, personality as a rivalry. He said it in the past, you know, the best times he's had were when Pride was doing its thing in Japan, and, of course, the UFC was beginning to find its way in North America. But, you know, you look at everything that UFC has to do this year with a new deal with Fox, with all of the events now, with the, you know, the networks of Fox that they have to produce product for. Yeah, part of me would like to have seen a few more maybe ex-Pride stars on it, but I know that they have to book an entire year's worth of shows, and right. And the fact that Quentin Rampage Jackson is on the card, the fact that, you know, there is a lightweight title fight, and I know people are saying, well, neither Benson Henderson or the champion Frankie Edgar are really a draw. I think it's still kind of cool that they are, you know, having a lightweight title fight culminate their return to Japan, and at the end of the day, Dana White is a businessman. It's you know, there's no future living in the past, and he has to start making a, you know, a UFC market there in Japan, if there's one to be made. I know they're very happy with the fact, I understand that there's, what, 15 to 17,000 tickets already sold. It is going to be a Sunday morning start there for the you know, the domestic market, which some people have taken umbrage with, and yet again, got to serve the biggest masters, and that right now is pay-per-view in North America. So, you know, all things considered, they have to do what they have to do, and I'm not too upset that there won't be a bigger Pride flavor. We know, those of us who lived it, those of us who still enjoy it, what Pride meant to mixed martial arts, and now what the Ultimate Fighting Championship means to the sport.
Mauro, as you know, I've had the privilege and honor to cover MMA events all over the world in a very short amount of time. I've been to Abu Dhabi, Australia, London, and obviously all over North America. How will this crowd compare or defer to those crowds? I mean, I hear so much about the Japanese crowds, but you've been there, you've experienced it. What will it be like? And considering that this will be a UFC show and not a Pride or Dream show?
And that's the big question right there. I mean, UFC events, you know, we're used to seeing them with the DJ pumping the music.
Right.
And it's, you know, like Dana White says, the most energetic live sports experience. And in Japan, for many people, including myself, and I remember my very first event, Pride Bushido 1, which was at the you know, the one good thing about the Saitama Super Arena, it can expand to its 35,000 maximum, but it can also retract into like a 15,000-seat arena. And a quick funny story, Boss Rutan and I, my very first trip to Japan in October of 2003, taking a look at this marvel of technology, this state-of-the-art edifice that is the Saitama Super Arena, little did we know there was a signal. We didn't understand the signal, and the walls actually started to shrink. So we were going to be caught in the walls. I mean, it obviously takes a long time, so we had to get the hell out of Dodge quick. But in terms of the crowd reaction, it's funny because at rock concerts, and I was very fortunate to see Aerosmith in 2004 in Nagoya, Japan, because the band had stayed in the same hotel where Pride was staying, and the manager was a fan of the sports, so he gave us tickets. The crowd at that rock concert was like a North American crowd. The crowd for Pride Fighting Championships and combat sports events are amazingly quiet, and I think the reason being there is such a respect for the sport and the athletes that they truly are invested in every nuance, every technique that is being put on display in the ring or the cage. And there's just this, it's really, I remember at the height during the, you know, 2005 Pride Final Conflict 2005, where Fedor Emelianenko defended the heavyweight title against Mirko Krokop, and Mauricio Shogun Hua at 23 came in his own, running through Alistair Overeem and Ricardo Arona in one night. Think about that for a moment, to win the Pride 205-pound Grand Prix that night. There were people dressed to the nines. It was like an Academy Awards environment where beautiful young couples were sitting there politely applauding. Like, it was just surreal. So I think for those of you that have yet to experience it, I'm thinking it will be similar, although the UFC, again, it is a different sport in general, different rules, different fighting surface, different product in a lot of ways. I'm going to be interested to see if it's the same reaction, but don't be surprised if you can literally hear a pin drop.
And Mauro, I want to go back to that. You say 2005, the height of Pride. Would you say, is it safe to say, and excuse me if this sounds like a dumb question, that the height of Pride doesn't even come close to what we're seeing now with the height of the UFC, perhaps it being UFC 129 in Toronto? Would you say that that was like 10 times bigger than what we're seeing now?
In a lot of ways, that event in Toronto, April, was very much like Pride because of the stadium atmosphere and the fact that so much attention, and people still talk about being at UFC 129, and Mark Hominick, of course, with his late great coach, just get goosebumps now thinking about it, where the one and only time that coming home should have been used. And by the way, not to go off on a tangent quickly here, but Jake Ellenberger, tremendous fight the other night, that day on my podcast. And by the way, thank you for the kind words, Ariel, for the podcast. I really appreciate it, and I put my heart and soul in this thing 5 days a week. But he told me when I asked him, please tell me you're not going to be coming to the cage, to coming home. He said, no way, no how. Well, he lied to me, the little bugger. So,
but wait,
anyway,
is it possible that the UFC maybe told him to do it? Is it possible?
Well, that very well could be. You probably know more about
and,
them than
and
I do.
Mauro,
maybe
you
that's
see,
what it was.
Mauro, did you see did you get the Fuel pre-show there in Canada or no?
No, we unfortunately, all I get on Sportsnet are the actual fights.
Oh, okay, because in my report, and not to go off on a crazy tangent here, but I did say cue the P. Diddy music because Jake Ellenberger is coming home, and I know we all hate hearing that song, but that was probably my proudest moment on Wednesday. Anyhow, continue.
All right. Well, to get back to the April show, though, you're right. But that the UFC did a stadium thing one time, not to, you know, again, mix and match, because of Pride and UFC in so many ways, and MMA today is so different. But we experienced that every month. I did that 31 times in 3 years, an average of 10 times 3 years, again, the majority of which were at Saitama Arena, the majority of which legitimately were 35,000-plus people. The you know about the Fuji TV production values. It was like, and I've said this before, a Super Bowl, a Broadway hit, the best band in the world, all turned into one. And I've always said this, and I said this to you, Ariel, and everyone. I just wish every diehard mixed martial arts fan, of which there are so many, and that's what makes the sport so wonderful, had the opportunity to have been at one of those Pride events in Japan, because I was spoiled, and I know I've been spoiled. I will never, ever forget. And I don't know if any event can ever replicate what Pride Fighting Championships was at its peak. The UFC is doing its thing, selling tickets, making money. But in terms of spectacle. And I know not everyone's a fan of that, but to me, it's all about the presentation and getting people hyped right from the parade of fighters from the get-go. And of course, Lenny Hart and Kay Grant. And again, to be able to sit there with, you know, the legendary El Wapo Boss Rutan to call, you know, even my harshest critics, Ariel, have said the call of the Fedor Emelianenko Mirko Krokop title fight in August 2005 was one of the best calls in MMA. And I you know, that touches me because I know how much preparation I put into that. I know how important that fight was to MMA. And it's just tremendous, even here now reminiscing with you. And I really do appreciate the opportunity. Of course, for me, my signature call, I guess, was Kevin Randleman knocking out Mirko Krokop in the first round of the heavyweight tournament in 2004, what had to be one of the biggest upsets. And people often ask, was that manufactured? Were you prepared to do that? You know me, Ariel. You know how hyper I am, yeah, how crazy and intense I get. If I was sitting on my couch at home, that would have been my exact reaction to what had transpired when Kevin Randleman faked the left hook, or faked shooting in and landed the left hook heard around the world.
Kevin Randleman has knocked out Mirko Krokop.
No, that's not a good...
my voice went a few octaves higher there, didn't it?
But no, you're absolutely right. And of course, we're talking to Mauro Ranallo, the voice of Strikeforce, the voice of the Score Fighting Series, the host of the MMA Show podcast, and the MMA Show, which can be seen Wednesdays on the Score in Canada. And we just have a couple more minutes left with him. We appreciate the time, Mauro. When I say, and I must admit, one of the things that I am most proud of, the pieces of work that I'm most proud of that we've been able to produce at MMAfighting.com was my quote-unquote backstage with you, and getting the opportunity to show people the real Mauro Ranallo and how great of a guy you are. But in that piece, you talked about forgetting your research packet prior to your first show and sort of flipping out, and then just a kind gentleman who worked for Pride went all the way back to the airport, drove 2 hours or so, got it, and brought it back to you, and you were just blown away by how kind he was. Other than that moment, when I say to you the Pride days, and other than the calls, is there something that you can share with us about how special was being in Japan during that time?
Absolutely. And in regards to that interview, and I mean, again, people say, Ariel and Mauro, get a room, you two Canadian bastards, all this and that. I mean, I honestly wanted to give Hugh that interview, and you don't know how much it's changed my life for the better, even with family, Ariel. There have been aunts and uncles. You know how Italians and all of our, you know, certain cultures are very close-minded or wanting to keep kind of that kind of stuff under the rug, the stigma. And the fact that you allowed me to be that open, and I've taken the ball and run with it. I'm very open about my battles with bipolar affective disorder, and I'm very encouraged by the amount of feedback, emails, and whatnot from people who are no people or who are battling themselves with depression, to know that someone, you know, like myself, I'm functional. I have my days. Don't think I don't. But I just, you need to have belief in your own self and know that there is help. And yes, maybe medication is the answer. I know a lot of people are not into pharmaceuticals and whatnot now, but I was one of those people. And for the last 9 years now, going on 9 years, I take a pill every day when I wake up. And for whatever reason, it balances out the chemical imbalance, and it allows me to do what I dearly love. Just like you, Ariel, living the dream, so am I. So again, I just want to say to your many listeners, if you know someone, or if you yourself are battling with depression or any kind of mental health issue, please reach out. And I mean this wholeheartedly. It does not have to be a death sentence. We've all lost people that I know could have been saved. And I just want to let it be known. And in terms of the one the other experience, my friend, was the camaraderie. It was unbelievable sitting in a restaurant after the event, or the days leading up to the event, where I could go over and visit with a Shooter Box Academy. And we'd start singing Italian songs, Rafael Cordero, Hujumar Federico, Vanderlei Silva, or at breakfast with Boss, where we would be regaling everyone with stories. Golden Glory would be coming over, Alistair Overeem. It was like this weird family, my friend, where everyone kind of respected each other. We'd share stories, and then they would go out and put on the greatest show on earth. And there are moments I look back on. Ricardo Arona against Kazushi Sakuraba, Vanderlei Silva against Yuki Kondo, where in hindsight, I think I was announcing an attempted murder. And I don't mean to shock or be hyperbolic or melodramatic. The rules of Pride, my friend, were so barbaric that, you know, looking back, it's like, holy shit, what were we doing? And yet, that was fighting at its... It was unbelievable. And so again, even talking to you today, I get back into the zone, and just an amazing time of my life. And again, one person to thank was El Guapo Boss Rutten, who literally meant it when he said, you know, we're going to work again together after doing that lousy movie in 2001. And thanks to him, I got to live the dream over in Japan and continue with it now.
Final thing, Mauro, before we go, I think it's safe to say, at least this is how I feel about the situation. From Condit Diaz, let's say, until John Jones versus Rashad Evans, the most anticipated, the most talked about fight in MMA, in my opinion, and the most promoted fight in MMA, is Ronda Rousey versus Miesha Tate. If anyone thought that when Zuffa bought Strikeforce, it was a death sentence for women's MMA, I think they're clearly mistaken right now, because I'm getting a press release every day from Zuffa about this fight, and they're putting out great videos from your colleagues over at Showtime Sports. The fight takes place March 3rd in Columbus, Ohio. It's a lot more talked about than the fight March 2nd in Australia, which features the debut of the flyweight division and Thiago Alves versus Martin Kampmann. How surprised have you been by how much Zuffa has been promoting these two women, and do you think that this is a sign of things to come from them?
Very pleasantly surprised, and thank you for actually bringing that up. I know Ronda Rousey has taken her fair share of criticism from athletes themselves, including former champion Sarah Kaufman, and the current champion she'll face, Miesha Tate. But Ronda Rousey gets the other aspect of the sport. She knows how to market. She knows how to talk the talk. So far, she's proven to walk the walk. And you know what? I will say this much, and yes, it's homerism. Yes, I'm biased. I am so proud of the crew at Showtime, including the Princess of PR, Annie Van Turnhout, Jason Bowers, who shot it, Earl Fash, who was the creative responsible for it. That promo that promotes the main event March 3rd in Columbus, Ohio, between Miesha Tate and Rowdy Ronda Rousey is exactly what we need for the entire sport, but especially the women. And kudos to UFC President Dana White, who in that surreal interview I did with him on Showtime and even this week has said, you know, he is pumped about that fight. And he's always said if there's marketable matchups to be made, and I know there are people listening right now who, again, disagree with me going back to the pro wrestling roots and whatnot. Ariel, you know it yourself. Yes, it's a fight. Yes, it's a sport. It's an athletic competition. But we are in the entertainment business, and you have to find a way to market yourself. You have to find a way to make yourself get emotionally connected with the audience. Otherwise, you're going to be, you know, you'll have an okay career, but you're not going to be making the big money.
He is the bipolar rock and roller, the voice of Strikeforce, the voice of the MMA Show podcast, the voice of the Score Fighting Series, the voice of the MMA Show, the former voice of Pride, and in my opinion, the best play-by-play man in the business. He is Mauro Ranallo, my friend, joining us right now. And you can catch that MMA Show podcast every day, Monday through Friday, 2 p.m. Eastern, except on Mondays when we're going up against him, but let's just say Tuesday.
And actually this Monday, because there is, yeah, no, you're right.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. We're taping. Okay.
It's okay. I already said that we were taping. Don't worry, Mauro. Thank you very much for the time.
But I do want to say this before you let me go, man. I'm so damn proud of you, man. And I don't care. We make friendships in this thing, but to see where you've come in such a short amount of time and to be able to say that I was just a little bit a part of it is amazing, man. Keep up the great work and do what you do, my friend. And let's keep kicking ass in 2012.
Laissez les bons temps rouler, right?
Merci beaucoup.
You don't know what that means. I said let the good times roll in French.
Oh, voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir?
Okay, we'll end it at that. Thank you very much for the time, Mauro. Always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Ariel.
There he is, Mauro Ranallo joining us, and great to get his insight off of Daniel Herbertson's insight. You know, Herbertson's insight was very much what was going on now, but wanted to hear from Mauro to find out what it was like. Never had the opportunity to cover an event over in Japan. Those Pride events on television looked amazing, and always wished I had the opportunity. On my wish list of places just to go and visit as a, you know, normal person, I always had Japan at the top of the list. Unfortunately, I never had the opportunity. Now I'm getting to go as a journalist covering a UFC event. The UFC's returned to Japan for the first time since the year 2000. So this is a huge, huge honor to me. And thank you to MMA Fighting for sending me over there to cover this event. Cannot wait for it. And I do really believe it is the best card top to bottom thus far in 2012. And one of the fights that people are very much looking forward to on Saturday night is Anthony Showtime Pettis versus our next guest, Joe Lozon, joining us right now on the MMA Hour. Joe, how are you?
I'm good.
It's great to talk to you, Joe, and we appreciate the time as you get ready to fight Showtime Pettis in Japan. Just curious, first things first, have you ever been to Japan?
Nope, this is your first.
Now,
the only other place I've ever fought outside the country is Montreal. And, first fight outside the country, first time being in Japan. So it's going to be all kinds of interesting stuff.
I know that you are a longtime fan and student of the game. When you heard that you would be fighting in the Saitama Super Arena, home to so many great Pride fights and other combat sports events, so what was your immediate reaction?
I was dreading the flight right off the bat. But I'm excited to fight over there. You know, the Japanese fans are great. You think about like all the glory days of Pride, things like that. And I'm looking forward to it. I think it's gonna be unreal.
So was this more of a burden than sort of like a blessing for you? Would you rather be fighting in say Chicago or Boston or somewhere like that?
Boston all day.
Yeah, yeah.
After that, it mainly is all about just trying to keep things common. Things that I'm used to. It's like I'm going out there, but it's not like it's some great. It's not like it's some vacation for me. I'm going out there because I'm working. So, I would like to keep things more normal. I would like to keep things normal, but, I would love to go to Japan.
Now, and just curious, what kind of a burden is it? Like, these are things that we don't really look at, but like, you're cutting weight. You have to make 155, and food, obviously, in the days leading up to the fight is very important. You can't go to the grocery store, I guess, and maybe you will be able to, and look at, like, how are you going to be able to adapt and make sure that you're eating the right things as you get ready for the weigh-ins on Saturday over there?
The big thing is I think we will be able to hit the grocery store. The big burden for me is going to be I don't eat sushi, so I don't eat fish, I don't eat any of that stuff. So I know that's going to be, like, everywhere we go, that's going to be a big part of it.
Yeah.
But I think that, we're going to get a former girl over there, and I've been told that chicken and things like that aren't too tough to come by. So I think that we'll be okay. I don't anticipate too many problems. But, again, it's not as simple as it would normally be.
Right.
You know?
And going over there and having to deal, I've heard a crazy thing, like, if you really want to get your body right in terms of dealing with jet lag, for every hour that the clock goes back when you go somewhere, like, you have to, like, that's a week. Is that true? That you, like, let's say you're going somewhere that's three hours back, you have to go 3 weeks before in order to get your body right. Is that true, or am I crazy?
I don't buy into that stuff too much. I'm sure it has some effect, but I don't think a week. I'd say maybe a day would be ideal. So it'd be nice if I was out there, starting last week. But, I think I'll be okay. I'm very fortunate in, like, with sleep habits. Like, I could be at an event and I could fall asleep in the stands. Like, if I was, wouldn't matter how loud it was, could be the Super Bowl, could be the World Series, could be anything, I can fall asleep. So I don't think I'll have any problems, with that stuff. I think we're going to get up. One thing that's a little weird is we fight Sunday morning.
Right.
So it's Saturday normal time here, but in Japan it's Sunday morning, like, early. So, I think that we're gonna get up at, 4 or 5 a.m. every single day we're out there and try to, get a little more adjusted. Because normally I don't just wake up and then go and fight right away. Usually we have, like, a whole day ahead of us.
That is fascinating. So have you been doing that back home in Boston as you prepare, or are you only going to start doing that once you get to Japan?
The last couple of days I've been staying up a little bit later each night. Like usually in camp I try to get to bed before it gets too late, like usually like 11:30, something like that. And, but the last couple of nights I've been trying to stay up a couple hours later each time. So, like, last night I was up until about 4:30. Tonight I think I'm going to I'll probably be about the same thing. We leave tomorrow morning, so we have to leave my house at, like, 6. So I think I'm going to stay up till about 4. I'll sleep for 2 hours, get up, leave at 6, and then try to sleep as much as I can on the flight. Kind of cut that time down a little bit.
And just to be clear for those listening to this on Monday, when you say tomorrow morning, it's actually Saturday morning because we're taping this on a Friday. Is that earlier than you usually go out to a fight?
Yeah, usually, we'll go out on a Tuesday for a Saturday fight. So this time it's going to be, Saturday for a Sunday fight. So a little bit earlier, a couple extra days. We expect to pretty much be garbage the first day or two we're out there.
Right.
So this will give us a little bit of a cushion to kind of get adjusted.
Have you talked to any fighters from the United States who have fought over in Japan and talked to them about how they've dealt with the jet lag and the other obstacles over there?
I've talked to a couple. They've all said that, the jet lag's going to suck for a couple of days. But it's generally not too bad. I think being out there a couple extra days early will help us a lot.
Yeah. You know, I thought prior to them announcing the Diaz versus Jim Miller fight that this could be a number one contender fight. Then Jim Miller beats Melvin Glard, who you already beat in Houston, and all of a sudden they put that fight, main event, Fox, and now it seems like that's the number one contender fight. Did that disappoint you? Did you think that they should have waited out to see what happened in this fight before really deciding who the next number one contender would be and who would be fighting to fight for the number one contendership, if you know what I mean?
I kind of think the opposite. Once they announced that fight and the timing of it, I think that that still puts me in Pettis as a number one contender fight. Just because I don't think that Frankie or Ben are going to want to wait 6 or 7 months before they actually fight again.
Right.
So I think that they're generally guys that try to stay busy and stay active. I don't think they're going to wait that long. You know, so, I mean, it could be that long, but I would guess that, you know, Pettis or I, you know, the winner will be fighting the winner of the main event. And I think that the winner of Diaz and Miller will be they'll be the next number one contender.
Has anyone at the UFC told you that you are fighting for a shot to fight for the title?
No, but you know, from talking with Joe Silva, he kind of led me to believe a little bit that part of the reason why me and Pettis were going out there was because if something happened with Ben, then one of us would step up and we'd be fighting for the title.
Oh wow!
So you know, that was like, he didn't completely come out and say like, "Oh, this is exactly what's going on." He's like, it would be a really good thing to have two top ranked guys out there in case something happened with Ben. So that's what kind of leads me to believe that, you know, he's got to be putting us right there at the top. So I think that we still get the first shot.
I was reading some of your, I guess, your tweets, and you can follow Joe, twitter.com/JoeLozon, very active online, video blogs and whatnot. And it seemed like you were still a little annoyed at Melvin Gallard as he prepared for his fight against Jim Miller, that he kept, like, almost turning the knife on you, even though you beat him. Is that accurate?
Always super nice, you know, before the fight, after the fight, you know, everything was always like, hey, how's it going? You know, always really friendly. And then, you know, but then I keep seeing all these interviews like, oh, well, Joe didn't beat me. He's like, I beat myself. It's like, no, I smacked you in the face with my fist and you went down and I choked you. Like, I'm pretty sure I'm taking credit for that. So, you know, a little bit, you know, and I kind of feel like we kind of set the game plan, you know, for beating Melvin. You know, you come forward, you know, you don't act scared of him. You don't let him start to get off. And, you know, I think that, you know, he kind of falls apart a little bit. And, you know, that's exactly how Miller went. And, you know, our fights were, you know, identical. You know, mine was a little bit quicker. I didn't take a couple bumps that Jim did. But, you know, it was like, how do you lose, you know, two fights the exact same way? You know, it's like, what kind of progress or improvement did Melvin show from when I fought up to this one? You know?
Do you feel like you get the respect that you deserve at 155? Looking at all the rankings, I know most fighters don't really like the rankings and think that the people who do them are dumb. But when you look at them and you talk, do you feel like you get that respect that you deserve?
I like flying under the radar, you know, so I'm not the guy that's out there looking to get all kinds of respect and appreciation and all that kind of stuff. You know, like I like to go out and have good fights. You know, I like to have exciting fights, but you know, I have no problem being the underdog and, you know, kind of flying under the radar a little bit.
You're now on a 2-fight winning streak. That's your longest. You had another one in the UFC a few years ago. Not your longest of your career, but in the UFC. Why haven't you been able to go on a longer winning streak than just 2 fights?
I think I did 3 before.
Okay.
Because I beat Pulver, then I beat Brandon Melendez on the finale.
Oh, right. Okay,
so
yeah.
So that was a 3. You know, honestly, like, I think the inconsistency stuff has never been a lack of training hard. Sometimes it's training too hard. You know, people get, you know, I catch a lot of crap sometimes about, you know, gassing and cardio and things like that, you know, but I come out and I push hard, you know, like I can be in great shape, but when you push as hard as I push, you know, it's tough to maintain that pace, you know, and on one hand, I would like, you know, I could kind of slow down a little bit and I could pace myself and I could be like everyone else and have great cardio and never finish fights. But I would rather push and try to finish people. And you know what, if I get tired because I was trying to finish guys, and I can deal with that. You know, I don't ever want to be a guy that's, you know, never finishes anyone, but is known for having great cardio. Usually, if you have great cardio, you're not known as being a great finisher. Hmm. And I would rather be a finisher than a cardio guy.
Pettis has fought in a 5-round fight, and he's gone the distance. He went the distance his last fight. What do you think of his cardio, and how are you going to try to match it? Because, as you mentioned, there have been people who have said, you know, go to the second round with Joe, and things start to change a little bit, as you alluded to. So how are you going to try to match his pace?
You know, I think we're just going to put it on him. You know, I'm sure that his game plan is going to be to, you know, kind of ride out the first round. Be safe in the first and, you know, and then, you know, take it to me in the second, you know. But But a lot of other guys have had that same game plan, you know, and I've still overwhelmed them in the first, you know. So I'm going to go out there. You know, he's got great cardio, but, like, in the fight with Ben when he went five rounds, you know, it wasn't the fastest paced fight. I don't know, it was the third or fourth round. Like, he was pretty much on Ben's back the entire round, you know, just kind of hanging out, resting, taking it easy. So, it's easy to have, you know, really good cardio when you're not doing a whole lot of work.
Did you game plan for any crazy kicks? Like, did you have someone do showtime kicks off the cage and anything unusual, or do you not really pay attention to that stuff?
We did it. You know, I don't expect, you know, Ben's had a whole, Pettis has had a whole bunch of fights where he's tried crazy stuff, but he's actually, you know, landed one good kick like that, you know, in all of his fights. So I'm sure that he'll throw something. But I don't expect, you know, for some devastating kick to come. I think it's more so just keep your hands up and be smart. I have a couple guys in camp that they can throw all kinds of crazy kicks like that. So we definitely worked with them as much as we could and had them throwing that stuff. But I don't anticipate it being a huge factor.
Did you bring in anyone to emulate his style, or did you surround yourself with the usual suspects?
Mainly usual suspects. Like, I have a couple other, you know, I have a lot of good training partners and, you know, local guys and things like that. So I really focus on, you know, bringing in guys that had a little bit better style that matches up well. I didn't, it wasn't a case of me flying in any firing partners or anything like that. So I brought over Ricky Lindell again for this camp. I'm working on my jiu-jitsu and all that stuff. But nothing crazy for kickboxing.
And he showed improved takedown defense against Jeremy Stephens. Given that, people have said that his wrestling has been an issue, especially in the Clay Guida fight. What do you think is his biggest weakness, though? What's the thing that you're going to try to exploit when you meet him next week?
I don't think about that too much. But I think if you look at Pettis, I think he's good everywhere. He's good on his feet. He's good on the ground. I think that his wrestling is definitely his weakness. But I think that part of that is because he's content to be on his back. You know, he's got Ben Askren out there helping him with his wrestling. But I don't think that Ben is your typical run-of-the-mill wrestler. You know, he's got a lot of kind of funk style stuff. So I don't see that as like, I'm sure this should be better, but, you know, that wouldn't be my first choice for a wrestling coach. So I don't know how much that is going to equate to, you know, helping Anthony train.
Yeah. And by the way, I saw your video blog that you put out, which was awesome with the camera that you had on your head. What was that thing called?
Yeah.
That was incredible.
It's called, I think it's a Hero 2.
Yeah.
It's like a high-definition camera. It'll do like 60 frames a second. It's pretty sweet. So it's got like a pedestal mount. So we taped that pedestal on top of my head, on top of my headgear. So it's kind of – we did like four or five rounds, and we didn't get a ton of usable footage, but – you know, we got some stuff. You know, it's pretty cool. Like, every time we've done it, we've gotten a little bit better footage. So hopefully down the line we'll do some more stuff like that.
Next time I'd like to see it on your training partner so that we can see you going at it. You know what I mean? That to me.
Yeah, that was kind of something we talked about. But, you know, it's tough doing training vlogs because you really don't want your opponent to see you training.
Ah, yes.
Just because you don't want to show, you know, you don't want to give them habits or tendencies to see exactly what you're working on. You know, for this, it was kind of nice because it didn't interrupt my training. It wasn't like we had to do something that was specific. You know, a lot of times, like, you see media workouts, and people aren't going to do what they've been game planning. They're going to do run-of-the-mill techniques or maybe some specific stuff that, you know, is not even what they plan on doing. You know, it was like all that, you know, kind of strategic aspect of it. So it was kind of nice where I could just kind of do what I wanted. I could do my normal sparring. And it was a little different having the headgear on, but... I didn't have to really do too much because you couldn't really see what I was doing. You could just see my hands a little bit.
Right. And just curious, because I did see your brother Dan in the video blog. Are you guys back together now training? Because there was a time where it seemed like you had a falling out.
We're brothers.
Yeah.
I think that's always going to happen. I think that, you know, Dan kind of, you know, said some stuff. I said some stuff. And it was more so, I think people blew it up a little bit more than it was. It was just, you know, typical two brothers fight. I think we were just a little more vocal about it than most.
All right.
But Danny's been in the gym training a lot. You know, he's been doing a great job. Super proud of him. You know, he's been in the gym a lot. So he's put together a bunch of wins. You know, I think that, you know, he'll be back in the UFC pretty soon.
Can we expect more video blogs over in Japan, particularly when you guys prank each other and try to give each other uncooked meat and perhaps really get each other sick?
All of that and more.
Oh,
you know.
Fantastic.
So we'll be out there for a little bit longer, especially the first couple of days. Like, we're really not going to do a whole lot of training and things like that. Just kind of adjusting.
So, you know, we're going to walk around Japan and, you know, kind of see what's going on. And, you know, we got a couple of those GoPro cameras. I got, you know, flip cams and iPhones and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, we got all kinds of ways to, you know, record video and things like that. You know, like one of the things that people have been talking about is like all these Twitter bonuses and things like that, you know. So I won the first round. I won the most creative. And basically I took a whole bunch of that money and I put it into, you know, video stuff. Like I bought an awesome, you know, we bought some cameras and we bought some mics and we bought some all kinds of stuff like that. So, you know, we're going to try to really, you know, pick up the level a little bit for this camp.
So,
you know,
by the way, do you know who decides those tweets, most creative and whatnot? Is there someone at the UFC? Like, do you know who exactly the person is, and can you bribe them, or how does that work?
I think it's Dana, so I don't know how much I can bribe him.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's true.
You know, I think that there's people that do like all the social stuff that they kind of keep an eye out, and they highlight what different people have done, and then I think you actually helped me on the last one, because when I released. I announced the fight with Melvin on my website, and I did it through Twitter and Facebook and things like that. And then it got picked up by a whole bunch of people. So it got picked up by, you know, you retweeted it, a couple other people, and you know, and they can see all that stuff, obviously.
Right, right.
So, you know, so I think that was what kind of helped me out a little bit, you know. But I think it all goes to Dane. I think he's like, oh, I like this, or this guy did a good job, or this or that or whatever.
So when we're off air, I'll give you my address where you want to send me a portion of that check.
I'll send you a t-shirt.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, and I can't wait. You're going to have, a Japanese-themed t-shirt, right? You always do that for every fight that, you know, like, the, you make yep. it, like, local, right?
Yeah, yep. So we've done some kind of, like, you know, custom JL shirt for all the fights. And well, pretty much all my fights. I think I've missed, like, 2 out of, like, 11 fights. And, you know, so for this one, the sponsor wanted us to kind of design the shirt. So we designed the shirt, you know, pretty much from the bottom up. You know, and did it exactly as we wanted, put all kinds of awesome stuff in it. So I was supposed to, I've been trying to get the link for a couple of days to put it out there so people can buy it. And so hopefully I'll have that, you know, it should be up by the time, you know, this is airing.
All right, well,
you know, but I should have that soon.
Looking forward to that, looking forward to the video blogs, and most importantly, looking forward to your fight against Anthony Pettis, one of the best ones on the card, UFC 144, this Saturday live on pay-per-view from Japan. Always a pleasure, Joe. Good luck in the fight, and we'll see you over there in Tokyo and Saitama in just a couple of days.
Awesome. Sounds good. See you there.
All right. There he is. Joe Lozon, J-Lau, as they call him. And you can follow him on Twitter, twitter.com/Joe Lozon. A highly anticipated fight against Anthony Showtime Pettis this Saturday live on pay-per-view. All right. Let's close out the show with our final guest and a man who was supposed to make his UFC debut on Wednesday in Omaha, Nebraska, at UFC on Fuel TV number 1. Unfortunately, moments before the fight, he injured his ankle in the locker room and was ruled out of the fight by the doctor, and now has to be on the shelf for several months. We'll talk to him about all of that right now. Pleasure to welcome in for the first time Sean Loeffler to the show. Sean, how are you?
Oh, how you doing? It's really an honor to do an interview with you and get to talk to you.
Oh, well, it is an honor to have you on the show, Sean. And first things first, and I appreciate that very much. Very sorry to hear what happened to you. My heart goes out to you. I know how devastating it must be, especially for someone who's been in the sport for 12 years. Let us first get the real story here. What exactly happened that ruled you out of the fight just moments before on Wednesday evening?
Well, I was warming up. I mean, I've never felt better, of course. And I feel like if I didn't have bad luck, I wouldn't have any luck at all. My coaches were saying, they got me all warm. I got my, as you call it, your first wind, because you want to go into your fight with your second wind or your second blow. You feel a lot better that way. So I got my first wind out and was feeling amazing. And Bert, you know, from the UFC said, you're up in 5 minutes. And my coaches said, all right, we're going to do one more minute of work, and then we're staging. And they're like, this is go time, baby. We waited 12 years. And I went on the mats that the UFC provides, and to do 5 tuck jumps. That's how, when you jump as high as you can and tuck your knees to your chest. And on the first one, I landed with my foot in between a crack in the mat, and my ankle turned over and hit the mat, and it went crack, crack. And, you know, Trevor Whitman from Coach Training Center was watching right there, and Uriah Faber and all these guys, and they looked at me, and I could tell by the look on their face that it wasn't, like, I mean, I fell on the ground, obviously, and I jumped right back up and started jumping around, and And Trevor said, that's horrible. And then I was like, oh, my gosh. And so I was like, I'm fine. And my coaches are like, just stay focused, Sean. And I looked down, and my ankle was like the size of a softball already, and this was 20 seconds after it happened. And so then Bert was called over, and the doctor was called over, and they rushed me into the side bathroom, and the doctor starts pushing on my ankle, and there's two doctors there, and one of them's like, I think he broke his fibia and tibia. And I'm like, no, I'm fine, I'm fighting. And they're like, does that hurt? And I was like, no, and even though it was excruciating, they're like, can you jump up and down? I started jumping up and down, and I was wincing a little bit. They're like, jump on one leg, and I was like, I've never felt pain like that before in my life. I'm like, I'm good to go. And they're like, all right, kid, you're at a big disadvantage, but if you want to fight, you know, it's your career. And then I was walking back out to the mat, and then my coaches were like, can you throw a right hand? And I was like, and I kind of threw a Superman punch variation because I couldn't put my foot down. And they're like, Sean, you can't plant on your foot. And I was like, we're fighting, we're going. I was like, carry me out there. I was like, just carry me out there. We'll make it part of my walkout. You know, I throw money out. You see my walkouts. I was like, I'll stand like the Karate Kid in the ring. People think it's fucking funny or freaking funny. And I'm gonna fight. And then I took one more step to go grab my water bottle. I fell back down and my ankle rolled over again. And then the doctors came over and my coaches and Greg and Bert from the UFC, and they said, we can't let you fight at this big of a disadvantage, and just started crying. That's pretty much it.
If they would not have noticed that, if they would have said, okay, you can fight, would you have gone out there essentially on one leg?
Absolutely. I mean, my coaches were I wanted to still. I mean, I put my head in Tony Lopez's chest, and I was just like, I felt like such a wuss. I mean, I was just like weeping, you know, it's been 12 years. And my coach was like, Sean, we can't let you make a UFC debut after 12 years on one leg. Like, my coaches just said, we can't let you do it. And then Joe Silva and Dana came up to me afterwards, and they said, you guys made the right decision. They're like, the worst thing you can do is, I believe Dana, his term for it to me was Tito Ortizism. He's like, the worst thing you could do is go out there and look bad or lose, and then afterwards say, well, what happened was in the locker room, I broke my leg or whatever.
Right.
He goes, we want to see good fights. He goes, the dumbest thing you could do is go out there on one leg at that big of a disadvantage. And the commission would have never let me gone out there when, I mean, you guys saw it on TV, you could imagine what it looks like now, you know?
And just curious, I mean, considering, and we're going to get into your backstory in a little bit, but considering all that you've been through and you're finally there, you weighed in, your moments before, what exactly is going through your head at this point? Because we haven't seen something like this for many, many years where a guy gets injured backstage. I mean, it's so rare. What's going through your head when they tell you you can't do it? And on top of that, you're actually injured and you're in pain. If you could just take us back to that moment and describe how you were feeling.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a moment I'll never forget for the rest of my life. I mean, the first time I fought on live television, 35 seconds into the fight, I was fighting a journeyman guy that was 11-17 about 5 years ago, and I had a compound fracture in my arm, taking him down. The second huge fight I had on Bellator, 3 weeks before, my coach was shot and killed, and I had a broken hand. And then now it was four minutes before I was supposed to go, I tear the ligaments in my foot. So at this point in my head, two things were going on. The first thing that was going on was my adrenaline was starting to drop, and I'd never realized how much it masks pain until this moment, because then I started realizing this really hurts. And then the second thing I kept thinking is, I'm going to wake up. And this sounds so cheesy. I was like, I'm going to wake up. It's going to be Wednesday, cold as hell in Omaha, Nebraska. And I'm going to wake up going, wow, what a scary dream that was. Like, what a nightmare that was that I just had. And then I'm going to check my mouthpiece, my cup, my shorts, my walkout banner, drink some coconut water, some oatmeal, and hard-boiled eggs. And we're going to go to the arena. Like, that's what I kept thinking. Like, And I know people might not believe that. I say, oh, he probably did. Like, that's what I was thinking. I was like, this is a dream. Like, there's no way this happened to me again. There's no way. Like, not after 12 years. And then as the pain really started to set in, I started realizing, like, you can't hurt this much in a dream. And then I looked at my coaches, and I was like, guys, I think we need to get me to the hospital like now, and they're like, yeah, they're getting you your check and stuff. And then I just started realizing, thank God for adrenaline, because this stuff really is starting to hurt. And those were the two things I was thinking is, wow, this is really hurting, and I'm actually not going to wake up. This is really happening, you know?
Unbelievable. And the UFC did give you your show money. They gave Buddy Roberts his show and win money. And then they took you off to the hospital. I actually was standing right beside you as they were carting you off and asked the UFC if we could do an interview for Fuel TV, but they said you had to get to the hospital right away. What happened then, and where are you now as you speak to us on Friday afternoon?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in Oceanside, California at my house.
Okay.
My girlfriend, and I'm waiting actually to, I've got an MRI later today, and then I got a new puppy, a Neapolitan Mastiff that gets delivered, and I named her, you know, you have to do the paperwork, and I named her Zufa last week, so I'm waiting to get my dog Zufa, and then I've got a 3:30 appointment for my MRI, and I'm just laying in bed here and looking at this, this pineapple that's attached to the side of my right foot. It's all black and purple.
So what is the official prognosis here? Did you break any bones or just ligaments? And which is almost just as bad.
Luckily I got the x-ray at the hospital, at Creighton Hospital in Omaha. And the doctors there, they brought in some specialists right away and a bunch of x-ray machines, and they x-rayed everything. And they were shocked. There's not one bone broken. They said, in fact, I guess the way a bone works, I found this out, is the fibia and tibia, they go together. And if there's not that much space, that means the bones have been kind of compressed, and that's bad. And they said there's tons of space, so that's great. There's no break, no fracture, no hairline fracture, no fragments, nothing when it comes to that. Now, when it comes to strains, they said it's definitely at least a third-degree strain. Possible tear of the fibula or tibia ligament, maybe both of them, they said, but we won't know that until the MRI, because the swelling was so severe at the time. I mean, my foot looked like an IV bag. It was just, by the time we got to the hospital, it was incredible. I'm sure it didn't help that I was doing wind sprints and shadow boxing right after it happened, trying to think, like, keep blood, do it, we're fighting. So they couldn't do the MRI there, so we're waiting today. And regardless, I've been told it's pretty much the same heel time. So, you know, they said 6 weeks. I stay off it, you know, on crutches, take weight off of it, you know, the rice, rest, ice, compression, elevation, and then start doing some rehab for about a month and then back to full-on training. So I would say, you know, maximum 4 to 6 months would be very, very maximum before I can fight in the UFC again. And Joe Silva and Dana have been pretty amazing. They're like, dude, you're not a sissy. You're yelling at the doctors backstage, yelling at, you know, lying to people about the pain so you could go in and fight. They're like, that's what we want. You've got a rainbow mohawk. You look like a cartoon. You fight crazy. You throw money out. They're like, you had 120 people fly out from, you know, California to Omaha. They're like, just keep your head, you know, in it because you're in the UFC. So, you know, I've tried to look at the bright side.
You had 120 people fly out. What was it like telling them? Like, how did you get the word out to them that you wouldn't be fighting? Because they were probably expecting you to go out in just a few minutes.
Yeah. There's so many funny little backstories, bro. My coach, Tony Lopez, who was Buddy Roberts' last opponent, as a lot of people know, he was one of my coaches, including Bob Bass, the first, like, American black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and Charlie Kohler from San Diego Fight Club. And my friend Larry, the guy that he's just a locksmith, my best friend, that got me into the UFC by emailing Joe Silva and just talking to Joe, texted Tony 30 minutes before I was going out with a text that said, how's Sean feeling? Tony texted back, oh, he got hurt, fights off. And Larry put, what? And Tony writes back, laugh out loud, just kidding.
Oh.
He looks so good, it's making us nervous.
Oh, no.
And then 25 minutes later, my ankle goes bad. And Tony just is like, I feel so bad. I put that out in the universe. I was like, coach, it ain't your fault. And so we were telling people right away, we were telling people, and all of my people left the event. They were there to see me. They were like, we're not sticking around. Like, you know, no offense to these other guys, but, like, we're going to meet you at the hospital or we're going to go back to the hotel. So about 80 people went back to the hotel, and about 20 people came to the hospital, and we just kind of took it from there. And then, you know, they waited for me to get back, got back. They had this huge cast and all this other stuff attached to my foot, and went back to my room. I talked to my dad for a couple minutes, and then my girlfriend came in to the bathroom, and I cried for about 20 minutes straight. Like, I just couldn't help it. You know, I felt like, I looked in the mirror and then just started sobbing. And my dad stood outside the door. He said, just get it out right now. We still got to go to your after party and do good to your sponsors and stuff like that. And I kind of pulled it together, spiked my mohawk up, and went out and, you know, hung out for a couple hours, ate some barbecue chicken pizza, went to sleep, and got a wheelchair through the airport, and now I'm here.
The thing I'm most impressed with is how do you actually have 100 friends who are not only your friends but are willing to fly out to Nebraska to see you fight? I don't even think I have 5 people who would be willing to do that if I was in your shoes. Like, did you bribe these people, or are they actually really your friends? Because that, my friend, is a very impressive thing.
Yeah, I had about 87 people from Southern Wow. California, about 15 from Texas, and about 15 from the East Coast. And I paid, actually, out of all the people, out of, like, I think 116 people or something, I paid for 7 of the plane tickets just because the guys couldn't afford it. But everybody else paid for their own stuff. It's kind of like I've donated a lot of money in my area, and with some of the mistakes I've made or some of the bad choices I've made, I've always tried to rectify that and give back. And I'm kind of a type of guy that I never like to feel like I owe anybody anything. So if I borrow something from somebody, I'll give it back tenfold. If I do something for somebody, I always try to be the one to where I feel like I was the more generous one. That's just my personality, and I'm really appreciative. And after fighting for 12 years and training at so many different places and always kind of keeping in contact with the same people, I'm not one of those guys that train somewhere and then 5 years later doesn't train there anymore. Like, I'll still go by their gym, you know, once a month or twice a month just to say hi, and I always invite people to my gym. I own the compound in Oceanside, and I give a lot of money to the YMCA and Red Cross, and I don't know, I've got a daughter that I haven't seen in 5 years, and so people always, I take care of people for some reason, and I've, you know, once I bought my house, you know, about 8 months ago, I've got this guest bedroom that I always let fighters stay in, and I just tell everybody, like, if you ever need anything from me, like, if I've, you know, got 2 pennies, I'll give you 2 pennies. And if I don't, I'll stand outside a 7-Eleven. I'll ask somebody if I can borrow, you know, a dime, and then I'll get their business card and I'll give them a quarter back later. So it's just kind of my personality. And these people really wanted to support me, and I couldn't be more appreciative.
That is amazing. And you also glossed over this. You said that your friend who is a locksmith, he sent Joe Silva an email, and that's how you got into the UFC? What happened there?
Yeah, my friend Larry Oberle, he's been my best friend for years. The guy is just so unassuming. One of the most successful people you'll ever meet. He looks just like a guy that would be, you know, mowing your lawn in Oklahoma, basically. You know, I always tell him, I was like, you're so successful. Why don't you get all your teeth fixed? Why don't you do this and do that? And I think on him, he's 45 years old, you know, 40 years old. And he's just like, F you, man. And I'm just like, I'm just kidding, Larry. And he's been a really good friend of mine ever since I went to fights about 6 years ago I was supposed to fight at. And up in Ventura County, and my opponent refused to fight me. He was there from Oklahoma, but was like, basically, F this, I'm not fighting Sean. And so I went in the cage and was, you know, and was talking some trash to the guy who was there. I was like, can you believe this guy? Like, I showed up here to fight and he won't fight me. And then they put me front row, and in the seat behind me was this guy and his son, Justin. And he was like, hey, just saying, we're big fans. We've seen you on YouTube and whatnot. And I'm like, oh, very nice to meet you. And he's like, hey, I know you got a gym that you train at in LA, maybe sometime I could bring my kid down there. And I was like, dude, bring your kid down there for sure. Like, I'll help you out with gas money or whatever. He's like, I don't need help with gas money, but I'd love for my kid to come down and do some jiu-jitsu with you. So the next week he brought him down, and I met Justin, his kid. And so we kind of started talking, and then he he called me up and was like, hey, do you want to go to the Gladiator Challenge event? And I was like, yeah, I got tickets already. I'll just get you guys in. He was like, really? I was like, yeah, no problem. So he sat next to me there, and we just started becoming better friends, talking on Facebook. And he was like, you know, it's so cool that I just met you by sitting behind you at a fight, and now, like, we're friends and stuff. He's like, so many fighters look at me, and they're just like, who is this guy? And I'm like, yeah, I'm trying to be fan-friendly, you know. And we got closer and closer and closer, and he started flying out to some of my fights, and then he started just help, you know, being really supportive. And once in a while, he'd say, hey, I think I got a sponsor for you. My friend owns a jewelry company, and they'll give you, you know, a couple pieces of jewelry and $100. I'd be like, awesome, Larry, that's freaking rad. And so then, you know, I met his wife, and he met my girlfriend, and his son, you know, would get in trouble in school. So he would say, hey, could you talk to Justin for me? And I'd be like, yeah, no problem. And I'd tell his kid, like, what are you doing, man? You can't be a dick. You gotta get your stuff together. And we got closer and closer. And then one day I heard pounding on my window at 7:58 a.m. And my business partner, Claudia, was standing outside my window. And I opened the door, and she was crying. And I'm like, what's wrong? And I was like, hey, what happened to my dad? Like, what's going on? You know, my dad's a police officer. And I was like, well, what's going on? She's like, I can't tell you. You need to pick up the phone. And I was like, tell me what's wrong. She's like, it's not my right to tell you. And I pick up the phone, and it's Larry on the phone. And I'm like, what's up, dude? Is everything okay? He's like, yeah, you're in the UFC. And I'm like, what? He's like, I've been emailing back and forth with Joe Silva. And I explained to him, you're on a 6-fight win streak. You know, your last fight was against a 6-2 guy. The fight before that was against a 5-1 guy. And he gave you a 4-fight contract. And so he has some freaking locksmith that's just been a friend of mine from cage fighting and giving me a UFC contract.
That is
so obviously I flew him out there and whatnot, and the rest is history.
That is unbelievable. What a friend. And you mentioned also, you know, I was reading your UFC.com bio, and one of the questions that they asked you was, why do you fight? And one of your answers, you said some other stuff about, you know, your background, but it was for your daughter, who you haven't seen. You also mentioned that in this interview, you haven't seen her in 5 years. And then I started reading about your life, and what an unbelievable life, the stuff that you've had to overcome. Just mind-blowing. You know, and I'm sure you're probably sick but of talking about this, but for those that don't know about what you've had to overcome to get to this point, if you could just give us a sort of recap of what you've had to overcome since your parents, from what I understand, got divorced when you were around 17, and then things really started to change for you. Is that not correct?
Yeah, no. I mean, I had the best parents in the world. They're still the best parents in the world. My dad and my mom. My dad was a police officer, 31 years LAPD, and then 7 at Carlsbad. And my mom was a Catholic school secretary. And I grew up going to Catholic school in Manhattan Beach, California. They call it like Beverly Hills by the Sea, a really nice area. We were upper middle class. You know, I didn't have as much money as all my friends, but my parents worked really hard to give me a really good upbringing, you know, in a good society and whatnot, and they did. And so everything was perfect. I had a twin sister, and everything's going great. And then when they got divorced, my dad had to move, obviously. They sold the house, and my mom went to Malaysia, and my dad went to San Clemente. And it was basically like, I mean, they're amazing. They were like, hey, you could live with us, and if you wanted. And I was like, well, my life's up here. I think I'm going to stay up here. Like, I don't know anybody there. I don't know anybody in Malaysia or whatever. That wasn't really an option. And so I was like, no, I'll make it here. And then I had a kid, you know, when I turned 18, and that kind of changed everything, because it wasn't really just like surviving, you know, living, you know, I was living in kind of a crappy area called Lawndale, which is right by Hawthorne and Inglewood, and just a crappy, you know, kind of gang area. And that wasn't that big of a deal. But then when you have a kid, I'm living in that area with no money, and electricity is always getting turned on and off. And so I started making some crappy choices to provide for my kid. You know, I had knew some friends that had money, and you know, in layman's terms, if, you know, they had money, I knew I could like get them some stuff that they would give me money for.
Right.
And then you start, you know, making bad choices, especially when you start, you know, getting more money because of that. And one thing led to another. And then you start, you know, rolling with some more unscrupulous characters, because you meet more people who are like, hey, this kid's, you know, kind of smart. He's well-spoken. He's kind of a businessman, and he's dealing with other shitty people. And so then crappy people would come around that were more, you know, legitimately crappy than the people you're doing before. Next thing you know, you're like, I'm dealing with some really, really gnarly people. And either I've got to be, I got to kind of change my attitude or this could get bad. And I did. And I kind of started like turning this person I never wanted to be, you know, to survive and whatnot. And it seemed like an easier way than working the three jobs I was working before and whatnot. And then I got in trouble, you know, got in a fight, with this guy that was, you know, banging out my fiance, my baby's mom at the time. I walked in on them, literally walked in on them in like mid-pump cheating on me and lost control of myself. And then everything kind of came to fruition in the head. And that's when I had to make a life decision. And I took responsibility for my actions. And I looked back that I'd been, you know, shot at and stabbed and you know, been in and out of getting arrested for stupid stuff. And then basically I had all this back child support owed, and the mom, you know, kind of put on a front, like, I'm going to do you a favor and have all the back child support erased if you sign over custody. And I did, assuming that, well, hey, everything's going to stay the same. She said I'd still get to see my kid. And then she just stopped dropping my kid off. And I got all these incident reports from the police department. And I went to court, and the judge, Sandra Thompson at Torrance Court, and this little guy, Alan Honeycutt, who was a city prosecutor, they explained to me, Sean, you signed over your legal and physical rights as a father. Like, she's the partitioner. She's the legal guardian of your kid. She is the physical guardian of your kid. And you don't have any rights. And she changed your kid's last name to her new boyfriend's name. Like, she let him adopt her, and they're moving. And you have as much rights to your kid as I have to your kid. So if she wants to drop the kid off, she can. And if she doesn't want to, she's not obligated to. That's the choice you made. And I was like, but it says right here that the visitation was going to stay the same. And they're like, it doesn't matter if it says she's going to give you $1 million every day for the rest of your life. She doesn't have to. Like, that's an agreement you guys made. The only thing that is sure is that you don't have any rights as a father, but you also don't have to pay child support or any back child support that's accumulated because my driver's license was suspended and I didn't want to go back to jail or prison or anything like that. So I was trying to do the right thing. And they say everything happens for a reason. So, you know, I look back and I go, why was I shot? Why was I stabbed? Why did I make the choices I made? Why was my daughter taken from me? Why was my coach killed? Why, you know, did I break, you know, mess my foot up 4 minutes before my UFC debut? And I'm kind of just, I'm still just accepting things, and I pray to God and hoping that the roller coaster that I'm on is going to end one day with that belt wrapped around my waist. And one of my friends on Facebook said something pretty funny to me, Ariel. He goes, dude, don't ever write a book because nobody will believe it.
Yeah. That is very true, and also amazing that despite all that, you were able to come out at the weigh-ins and throw money into the crowd. Certainly not you were like the million-dollar man Ted DiBiase out there. But by the way, just to be sure, how much money did you throw out there? Were those hundreds? I'm assuming those were hundreds, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, that was $28, actually. usually I throw out about, like, I'll throw out about, you know, 30, 40 bucks at weigh-ins, and then $60 or so at the fight when I walk out to the crowd. So it's usually I give $100 back to the fans of some beer money for people. Like I said, I appreciate the fact that I can fight in a cage in front of people for a living, and that I own a gym now and I own my own house. And even when I didn't have much, like I said, I'm the type of guy that wants to say thank you back to the crowd, but also put on a show. And I think part of the entertainment value of the UFC is doing some different stuff. And so I make it rain a little bit. You know, I talk some trash, you know, for marketing about stuff like that. When I fought in Philadelphia, I said, usually I make it rain and throw dollars out. But, you know, I fought some guy from Philly in Philly. I said, I'm going to throw out pennies and you guys can fix your bell with the copper. And, you know, I just like take little cheap shots and make a show of it. And I like to just give back and have the fans remember me. You know, Dana White always says, and everybody always says, like, don't be the guy that lays and rolls around on people. Be the guy people remember. Like, that's what the sport needs. The sport needs people with good attitudes, that have good personalities, that are outspoken, but that bring it, that don't just put on a show, but they bring it in and out of the cage. And so I've got a rainbow mohawk. I'm covered in tattoos. I talk trash and paint my toenails, and I throw out money. And when I fight, I kind of throw out money when I fight. I'm throwing Superman punches, spinning heel kicks, flying knees, flying arm bars. You know, I just go, because I don't really know any other way with the way I've lived my life and with what I've been through. I'm like, you might as well throw caution to the wind so you don't have regrets, you know. And I just want to be known for being memorable and being kind of like a fan favorite, hopefully.
And finally, are you working towards being able to see your daughter soon? And are you in contact with her? Like, can you email her, or have you not talked to her in 5 years as well?
I haven't talked to her in 5.5 years. Not wow. One bit of contact. The mom completely pulled her out of my life. The mom's name was Monica Noaker when we were together, and I believe she changed her name. She got married, maybe married and divorced even by now, to Monica Lyons, and changed my daughter's name to Amber Lyons from Amber Loeffler, like Lyones. And I've had some like private investigators and detectives help me try to like look into it, but it's hard with a minor to get any information about, you know, being a minor, especially with the fact that there was a big criminal case involving me because of the situation, getting a fight inside the house with, you know, her and the mom inside the house. So there's restraining orders, and it made it really tough, and still making it tough. But getting more notoriety and more interviews and whatnot, you know, I always, you know, commit things to my daughter and attribute, you know, any success or anything that I have to trying to get her back. And so anytime like anybody's listening that thinks they could help me with something like that, like if they're out there, like hit me up. My Twitter handle is Sean Loeffler, SeanLoeffler. Look me up on Facebook too. Like if you think you could help me, I know it might take some money, you know, and that's what hopefully these knockout bonuses from the UFC will help with, like some legal fees or whatever I have to do. And if I have to, you know, pay back child support for all the years that they took it away, like I'll do whatever I have to do. There's not a price anyone can put on my kid. You know, I'd sell my house and my business if it meant seeing my kid one day, you know, spending one day at Disneyland with her. So she's about to be 11, November 21st, and I haven't seen her since she was 5. So it's kind of, I don't know what more to do. You know, I've talked to people, and it's like when you don't know exactly what your kid's last name is, and you know the mom saying probably horrible things about you. So I'm kind of do this in an effort, two things. One, if I can reach out there and somebody hits me up and helps me out. And two, if when my kid's 17, 18 years old, and she's been told a bunch of stuff about me, if she ever finds out that she's got a different dad that is her biological father and she comes after me, I'll never say anything negative about her mother, but I'll be like, here's 375 interviews that I've done over the past 10 years, honey. You can make your own opinion about me, but I've never not wanted to be in your life. I've never not wanted to be your dad. I didn't have the option. And so maybe these little things will help smooth things over when that awkward time does happen to come, and I have to accept that, you know? So I don't really know what the plan is. It's just, I know where my heart is, you know?
Well, Sean, hopefully this interview can do a little bit and help. And if anyone's out there that is able to help you out with this, you know, we have some pretty good listeners and very loyal listeners. So hopefully if there is someone out there that can help you, I hope they do help. And really, really, really want to thank you for opening your heart to us here and sharing your story. And my heart goes out to you, my man, for what happened on Wednesday in Omaha. I know you will be back, and I was very much looking forward to seeing your UFC debut, and I know you will be back from this. And as everything in your life seems to have made you stronger, I think this will as well. So good luck with the MRI, good luck in the road back to the UFC, and cannot wait to see you make your debut sometime this year.
Oh, dude, thank you so much. Like, and I know it's corny, and like it really is an honor to talk to you. Like, I've looked up to you. Like, I remember seeing you for the first time, and I was like, who is this? Like, years ago, like, who is this guy that's getting all these, like, legit high-profile interviews and stuff? And to watch how you grew and whatnot, and now the recognition you get, and you're, like, the top guy, the top interview in the world about it. I've looked up to you, too, and not just saying that to, like, you know, powder your nuts, man. I mean, I've looked up to you, been like, wow, this guy's made it. Like, this guy went from being a little guy with a microphone with a sticker of a website on it to the top guy in the world. And so I think that's pretty awesome. And And, you know, if I could give a real quick shout out to a couple sponsors, just because they didn't get to get any exposure from the UFC. I just want to say Ground and Pound Fight Gear, Booster Fight Shorts, Lexani Rims, Head Rush, and Luxury Sports Limousine, Third Street Tattoo in Hermosa Beach, and Q's Restaurant. They all really, really stuck by my side through this. And the UFC, Dana White, Joe Silva, Zuffa, and guys like you, you know, giving me an opportunity and took some interest in what happened. Like, I look up to you a lot, man, and it's like, it's kind of like a cool thing to get to talk to you, you know?
I appreciate that a lot. That means a whole lot to me. You have no idea. And was very much looking to talking about your fight on Wednesday. I know I'll have the opportunity very soon. Thank you very, very much for the kind words. Good luck. And prior to your next fight, we'll have you on to talk only about good things in your upcoming bout in the UFC.
Awesome, man. Making me smile. I'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. There he is, Sean Loeffler, a great guy with a great story, and certainly went through some tough times in Omaha, Nebraska just a few days ago, but we'll overcome this. We know that for sure, and we'll make his UFC debut sometime very soon. And if you're a fan of the UFC and are going to check out a Sean Loeffler fight, you better be prepared, because as he just said, he throws money into the crowd. And if you're looking for some extra money to get some beer, well, Sean Loeffler may be able to help you out. And check him out on Twitter, as he said, twitter.com/SeanLoeffler, and also on Facebook. And if there is anyone out there that can help him in his search for his daughter, he said he hasn't seen her in 5.5 years. Wow, that would be something else. If a listener of ours can certainly put him on the right path, let us know what we can do. And if there's anyone out there who is listening that can help him, I'm sure he will be very, very appreciative. That was our final guest of the show, a very fun show, and I hope you enjoyed it very much. I want to end on this. We started this show in June of 2009. We've come a long way, and we've had our ups and we've had our downs, but we have never had a sponsor until now. And not only do we have a sponsor, we have a huge sponsor, my friends. This is a major – it may not mean much to the regular person listening, but it means a whole lot to me and to everyone working on the show that someone out there believes in the show and is willing to back it. And like I said, it's not just any kind of sponsor. It's the great people at Mio Energy, which is a company that was launched by Kraft. And I'm sure you know who Kraft is. I used to eat Kraft macaroni and cheese every single night as a young Canadian boy growing up. This is a liquid water enhancer, and they are the newest sponsor of our show, the MMA Hour, and they will be fully integrated into the show on next week's show. But I wanted to give them a special shout out and thank them very much. And you could check them out on Facebook. They've got a lot of cool things up on their Facebook page. It's facebook.com/MIO, which is pronounced Mio, which means make it, which means mine in Italian. So I like the little Italian connection there. There's an Italian connection in Zuffa, which means I believe brawl in Italian, which is obviously the parent company of the UFC. But really want to thank them. Basically, if you're wondering what this thing is, like I said, a liquid water enhancer, and it's zero calories. And what you do is you have a water bottle like this one, and you pour this thing in here. Whoops, just got it a bit on myself. You pour it in like that, and then you shake it like so, and then look at that. Look at the color change. Wow, that is actually amazing. And I'm not just saying that because they sponsor our show. I was going to put the wrong model. This is Mio, everyone. Mio Energy. Thank you so much to them. And that is actually really good, and it gives you energy. So I should be drinking this at the beginning of the show, not the end. I will do that next time. So I want to thank them very much. It means a lot to me that they're sponsoring the show, and they're going to be all over it. And hopefully that's a sign of big things to come for the MMA Hour. Isaac, you can hit my music, my friend. Took a little Mio bath here, but I tell you, it feels great. Not only does it taste great, it feels great on my hand and probably on my shirt as well. That's what I do for the good people at Mio Energy. Thank you so much to them. That is really great stuff. All right, so a great show. We appreciate you guys stopping by. Thanks to everyone who helped out. And I want to thank in particular Daniel Herbertson. Check him out on Twitter, twitter.com/DanielHerbertson. We will see him over in Japan
a longtime friend and a former colleague. He's doing great things now with Fighters Only, as he said, and a bunch of other people. So thank you very much to him for the insight. A bit of a negative Nancy there, Daniel, but we know where he's coming from. Just wanting the scene over in Japan to get better. And it is bleak times, but I think Japan will be back. And hopefully things could get back on track a little bit. We're not hoping for too much, but just a little bit with UFC Japan on Saturday night. Also want to thank my very good friend, Mauro Ranallo, for stopping by, dropping some insight on his time with Pride, and of course the upcoming Misha Tate versus Ronda Rousey fight on March 3rd, which we'll be at. I will be going from Japan back here to New York and then over to Columbus. And in case you're wondering, there won't be a show the following Monday, so in a week from now there won't be a show, but it will be on Tuesday or Wednesday. We're still trying to figure that out. Basically, we won't be missing a week. It just may not be on Monday because I'm flying back from Japan then, but we'll definitely be back on either Tuesday or Wednesday live. So definitely look out for that. I'll mention on Twitter. Also, thank you so much to Sean Loeffler. Good luck to him. And thank you very much to Joe Lauzon. Good luck to him. UFC 144 goes down this Saturday night from Saitama. I can't wait to get there. Peace.